Hey, Bonk.
Hello. Hi.
How are you doing?
Great. How are you?
I am doing, you know, great. Great's the word for it.
That makes me so happy. I love when you're great.
Yeah.
I feel like your baseline is most people's great. So
yeah.
When you're great, it's like super extraordinary.
I don't complain much, I don't think. Do I complain?
No.
What do I complain about anything?
No.
No?
You're a pretty easygoing guy.
There's got to be something I'm just like, about. I guess when tech stuff isn't working and I can't figure out why.
Oh, yeah, for sure.
That's my big thing.
That's the only time I see you get frustrated is when there's tech stuff or if there's like, usually you're so patient with customer service, but if it's like, like for example, there's been this saga with HP.
HP, yes.
It was just unbelievable.
It's the computer that's on the desk right now, yeah.
The only time I've ever seen you get frustrated, the other time I saw you get frustrated with customer service was when we ordered Wendy's for my birthday.
Because you wanted the Frosty Chino and it was your birthday.
Exactly. Merely because I wanted a Frosty Chino. That was going to be my birthday treat. And they forgot the Frosty Chino. But we ordered it through Grubhub, so you had to like work with Grubhub customer service.
Well, that's the thing. It's like if they just forgot an item. Like that happens about half the time I order anything from any service, you know. But it was the fact that it was your birthday and they were closing, and so I was just trying to, like, hey, do whatever we got to do to get a refund, because they're like, well, we can't send out another order, and I was like, all right, well, then just give me a gift card to cover another one. I'll put in another order right now, and I knew, like, the clock was ticking, and so I was just trying really hard talking to different people.
Then every time you'd get a gift, you'd get the gift card to cover an order,
yes.
Presumably, but then there'd be, like, $20 in extra charges, like,
yeah.
Delivery fees and all this stuff.
Well, because you wanted one item. You wanted the Frosty Chino. That's, what, $2-3? And then, yeah, when you're ordering online, it's just like, okay, well, everything winds up being $18 no matter what you're ordering.
Yeah, but even when you're frustrated talking to customer service, and the reason I'm sharing this is because I think it's a good lesson for everyone listening, you always tell the customer service agent, like, look, I know this isn't your fault at all. If I sound frustrated, I'm not frustrated with you personally.
Personal, no.
It's just the situation. So you make that abundantly clear, even when you are like super frustrated. It's very admirable how patient you are.
Well, it's just because I've been on the other side of that. You know, I've worked retail jobs. I worked at GameStop. I worked at AMC. You know, I worked
You worked customer service at Garmin.
Yeah, I did phone customer service.
Remember your history?
Yes, yes. Well, hey, if that's...
Remember your life, which you lived?
Is this a This Is Your Life episode?
Actually, it's about time for us to do a weather check if you want to go ahead and do a top of the hour weather.
Top of the hour weather check?
Yep.
Okay. Everything's in airplane mode. I wasn't prepared for this at all.
I just figured you could pull it off. I'm sorry.
Oh,
sue
okay.
Me.
Well, right now it's I'm not gonna sue you.
Sue me, Dan.
That would be a hilarious joke. I was like, all right, and I left right now and like went to a courthouse.
We go to the people's court.
Yes, yes, and then we have a lawsuit and hopefully it's aired. What was the thing we got? We were almost going to go on Judge Judy because we had a kerfuffle with our landlady in San Francisco.
Mm-hmm.
I forgot what the whole thing was. It was the dumbest, most boring thing where it's like we decided we're moving out to the East Coast, but we had like 10 months left on our lease.
Yeah.
And so like I did all the legwork to like Craigslist and like bring people in and
take
I found new buyers.
Pictures, yeah. Interviewing new buyers. We went through all, we did all of that ourselves. And the thing was too, in San Francisco, there's like
rent control. Yeah.
So she couldn't increase the rent substantially unless it was a brand new lease with new tenants. So us leaving was hugely beneficial to her.
Yes.
But the biggest issue ultimately that caused us wanting to bring her to court was that she wasn't going to return our security deposit for the last month because we weren't, or not even the last month, the month of like January or something. She was still charging us rent even though we couldn't even live there if we wanted to because she was replacing the floor. So it was uninhabitable. And she wouldn't give us our security deposit back. She ended up giving us like $500 of it.
And we looked up all the legal stuff and talked to lawyers and all that. And like she was totally in the wrong. And it was just like, what a giant pain in the ass that was.
That's the thing. It's like, you feel so bad when you think about the fact that, I mean, I'm sure so much illegal shit happens like that where it's just like, well, this is a landlord. What are you going to do? Because the tenant or whatever, even if they're being screwed over, you know, most of the time they probably don't have the means to take the landlord to court or for a drawn out legal battle. And I know there are a lot of instances where the inverse is the case where the tenant is, you know, manipulating the landlord. But I it just makes me sad when you think about, like,
how many
all the shit
screwed
that,
over.
Yeah, all the shit that happens where it's like, well, this isn't supposed to happen, but what can you do, you know?
Yeah, it's like, and even just, even if money is not the problem, it's like the process of all this is just the worst of, like, legal stuff. It's just, it's very confusing. It's very confusing. For the layperson, and you have to imagine, like, a landlord kind of has a leg up, because if they're going to go into that line of business, they know what they can get away with and what they can't, and they assume that their tenants probably don't, and yeah.
Yeah. So I guess we're never getting that weather check, but that's okay. Who cares what?
Well, you know, it's we got a nor'easter breeze coming in here right now. It's gonna be cold because it's winter.
Oh,
how about that?
It's very surprising.
Yeah,
it's tantalizing.
Yeah, I'm not a weatherman.
Well, you could be. You could be anything you want to be. You've proven that time and time again, Dan. If you want to be a weatherman, you could be a weatherman.
When you were a kid, or even now, did you hear, maybe this is a Kansas thing because of crops and farms and stuff, and I still don't know, I've not heard this since I was a child, so I don't know if it was complete bullshit, but I feel like adults who knew this type of stuff told me that, like, let's say you are running a farm or something and it hasn't rained in a while, that they've got stuff that they can do where they take planes up, like, above the clouds, and they can, like, sprinkle or dust stuff, I think, into the clouds to make it rain. Does this sound at all like a thing you've heard of?
There weren't a lot of, like, farms in New Jersey that I grew up on.
Well, there were in Kansas. I was not a farm boy, but, you know, there were a bunch of farmers in my family and stuff. So I assume somebody smart told me this. But now that I'm an adult and thinking about it, like, I don't think you can just sprinkle stuff into clouds and make them rainy.
Yeah. Did this person say that you have to do, like, some kind of Aztec rain dance for this to happen?
No, I think they said it was, like, a science thing where it's like, oh, yeah, put this
in
the clouds.
You take a helicopter up into the sky and then take a bucket of water and just jump off with the bucket of water?
No, I think it was like a way to make rain conditions happen.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
To manipulate the hemisphere.
If anyone knows, email us at paintingthestream@gmail.com or let us know in the Discord. I'm still confused about that.
Hmm.
If anyone knows farm stuff. Speaking of farm stuff.
Yes.
That is, there's just no way to turn that into a segue.
Farms are filled with growing things and animals, and animals often make a lot of noises.
And animals have a very astute hearing.
Sometimes, yes.
Yes.
They make noises like oink, like sometimes moo.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yes.
Dan and I actually just wrapped up watching an 11-minute compilation of screaming frogs. So
yeah.
If there are frogs on your farm, they might go, ah, ah.
Some of them seem like literal demons with their eyes and just like screams. It's like opening their mouths, but you can't see emotion on their face because they're a goddamn frog. And they're like, bah! It's just, it's not good.
Yeah, my favorite was the one that was like translucent, but you could just see its eyeballs
that.
And it was just like,
brr. No good.
Brr.
No good. Speaking of translucent frogs, is there a single animal in this movie? There's the dog.
We are animals.
We are animals.
Lest you forget, Dan.
You know who else is animals? Gene Hackman and Robert Duvall and Harrison Ford.
Yeah, they are.
That was seamless, right? That worked?
Yeah.
It was good. Okay, no. It was good. Great.
Passed my test.
Everyone agrees. It's good. Yes, folks. Kapapapalooza. Kapapalooza. Although, is it Coppola? Because I said on a stream recently, I said Francis Ford Coppola, and somebody, like, you know, I think making fun in a funny way, not like a mean way, mm-hmm. was like, wrote cop space A-L-L-A, like basically writing it phonetically the way I said it.
I love when people are really snarky when other people have wrong pronunciations. It's like, fuck you. We just read this our whole life. But, like, it's not, it's like, common.
To be fair with that one, I am a film major.
You were. You are no longer.
Do they not say that once you've graduated?
Well, wouldn't you say you're a film school graduate? Like, if
I have a film degree. How about that?
Yeah.
I have a film degree. Yes.
Anyway, it doesn't matter.
Is it Coppola? I think it might be Coppola.
Well, I don't know. Obviously, I've probably been getting it wrong too, Dan.
I feel like I've always heard Coppola.
Coppola.
I've always said Francis Ford Coppola, but I don't say it a lot because we hadn't seen any of his shit.
Well, it just goes to show you that there are different ways of hearing things.
Yes.
Which is kind of the crux
of the
conversation.
God damn it, we're good at this. 150
yes.
episodes, we're just in a groove. Here
and
we go.
This isn't your ordinary conversation.
No.
This is an extraordinary conversation. At least we don't figure that out until further into the movie. It starts off as a rather banal kind of thing. Anyway, I am getting too far ahead of myself before we kind of look at this film broadly. Gene Hackman plays a surveillance expert named Henry Call.
Yeah. And I feel like I don't know what was going on in the news when he died, but I don't think I realized that he had died.
I didn't realize Gene Hackman died either.
Wait, he didn't?
Okay, that's probably why.
Wait, I brought him up in conversation recently. I feel like an in-person or like a Zoom like work conversation or something asking about Gene Hackman. And somebody said like, oh yeah, he's dead. Like, it wasn't like, I saw a comment on a thing. Mm-hmm. It was like, I think I was on, like, a Zoom happy hour or something, and somebody was like, oh, yeah, he died a couple years ago. Well, and I was like, how did I miss that? No, I'm looking at Wikipedia. He's 91, and he hasn't worked since Welcome to Mooseport.
Well, thank God he's still alive, Mr. Yes. Hackman. This movie is incredible.
Yeah. He's really good in it.
Yeah, this is one of Coppola's movies from the 70s, this quadruple amazing series of films, Godfather, Conversation, Godfather 2, Apocalypse Now, all happened in the 70s, just churning it out. I think Norm Macdonald said something about how, like, there are certain times in people's lives where it's just, like, the confluence of all these, like, an external struggle and internal creativity. You just end up producing the best stuff of your life, and then it's kind of downhill from there.
Everything. You see that with musicians a lot.
Yeah, and I think it's you see it here with Coppola for sure. I mean, the 70s was just, like, holy shit.
I'm looking at the 70s on his Wikipedia right now, and you start with Patton from 1970.
And that's Patton, not patent.
That's correct. That is General George S. Patton, I almost said, but George C. Scott is the actor. Francis S. Patton? George Patton? What is Patton? What's...
General Patton?
Yeah, it was Patton? General Patton. But
Mike Patton?
Why can't... Who is it? Hang on. What's Patton's first name?
John C. Patton.
I don't think... Oh, my God. It's going to drive me nuts. Hang on. I'm clicking it. It's about General... Oh, it's George S. Patton. Oh, I think I said that amongst all those. Anywho, Patton was in 1970. The Godfather was 72. The Conversation and The Godfather Part 2 are in 1974. Mm-hmm. They were both up for Best Picture. Coppola was up against himself. Godfather 1. And then he made Apocalypse Now in 79. Just ridiculous. And then I look at the 80s and it's like, okay, well, The Outsiders, heard of that, but a lot of stuff that didn't really set the world on fire as far as I understand. But then Dracula kicked ass in the 90s.
Well, I still need to see Outsiders. But yeah, so Henry is a surveillance expert. The movie starts in...
Harry.
Is it Harry or Henry?
Harry.
It's Harry? I thought it was Henry.
I thought it was Harry.
It is Harry, you're right.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Sorry.
That's right.
It's Harry.
Yeah, Harry Call.
Harry.
Yeah.
The opening scene is really neat. It's like this slow zoom into a giant Union Square in San Francisco.
Yeah.
A busy, like, kind of center square,
like
courtyard.
A shopping area.
Yeah, with, like, all sorts of people just milling about. And there's a mime, and there's, like, live performers, and there's just seems like a very touristy, lots of tourists. Very different than the San Francisco that I knew when I lived there.
Just people shitting on the ground. And
people openly shitting, stabbing each other with scalpels, masturbating in the streets.
Yeah. I'll say, Union Square, did you ever spend much time there?
No.
I went up there a few times. I remember my mom and sisters were in town. We went there, and I think there were a couple bars, whatever I went to in that general area. And it's like, it kind of is still that like touristy thing where it's like that direct square is like, here's a nice hotel. Here's the Nike store. Here's this thing. But then you go one block like down Powell or something. Yeah. And it's just like, all right, poop city. All right, great.
Yeah. San Francisco's tough.
Garbage town.
Yeah. It's not a good place. At any rate. So it does this really slow zoom in where, you know, there's so much happening on screen because it's showing, the entire square. You don't know where it's going to land. Like, there's not one particular thing that catches your eye. It ends up landing on this couple that's walking. And, you know, you wouldn't have expected it because it seems like just a young couple. And it seems like they're just having a pretty standard conversation. At this point, you don't really hear what they're saying too much.
Yeah, and they're kind of like bouncing around between topics and stuff, so it's kind of hard to follow intentionally.
Mm-hmm.
One of the guy in the conversation is Frederick Forrest, who played Chef in Apocalypse Now.
Yes,
so,
yeah. Yes. It becomes very clear that they're being surveilled, and there's like microphones coming from windows overlooking the square from a guy who's near the couple who's like has this recording device and like a gift bag.
Yeah.
And they're operating out of this van, And all these mics are picking up all sorts of different frequencies. And yeah, they're just collecting this conversation of, between these two people and Fredo, who's also in this movie.
Yeah, which actually I looked him up because it's like, man, I feel like with a lot of these movies we're watching or intending to watch, we're seeing a lot of him. Like, I know he's in Dog Day Afternoon, he's in Godfather, he's in this, and it's like, why have I not seen this guy before? And I looked it up, it's because he died at 42.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, he had cancer and died. But so here is his film career. This is his filmography, and I believe I'm not leaving anything out. The Godfather, The Conversation, The Godfather Part Two, Dog Day Afternoon, and The Deer Hunter, which is another, you know, famous Vietnam movie.
Mm-hmm.
And then he died. And so it's like, he seems like all the stuff he was in, he was an actor in theater as well, but his filmography is incredible. And obviously, like, Coppola was using him constantly, so he probably would have gone on to have a much bigger career than he did.
Yeah, well, I mean, he's already in some of the best movies ever, so.
In like, pretty big roles, you know?
Yeah, for sure. So Fredo, I forget his name in the movie.
Stan.
Stan.
Yeah.
He's pondering out loud, I wonder what they're talking about. And then Harry says, like, more or less, he says, like, that doesn't matter what they're talking about. All I care is about the recording.
Yeah, it's not the conversation. It's never, like, the content of what they're talking about. Mm-hmm. It's just, I just need the words on a tape. It's like, it almost would have been the exact same to him if they were talking in Spanish and he couldn't understand it. It's like, as long as it's clear audio, that's all he cares about.
Exactly. So it becomes abundantly clear that, like, Harry does not ever try to interpret what's being said. He doesn't want to get involved. He doesn't want to get interested in what's being said. He just has a job for the client. He has this barrier up between what he's doing and what's actually going on. It's just two separate things. The client is just a job. You know what I mean?
It seems like it's how he tries to sleep at night, because I think he's definitely a smart guy and knows that what he's doing could lead to, like, bad consequences, and has in the past.
Well, it just seems like he doesn't try to think about that. And he doesn't want to. And when he's confronted with that in the movies, like, some of the coolest parts in the movie, we'll get to that. But that kind of philosophy extends to the rest of his life too. He has this barrier between himself and the rest of the world, between being an observer and actually living his life.
Mm-hmm.
We see him go home in his apartment, and he's immediately caught off guard because there's, like, a birthday gift waiting for him, and someone wished him happy birthday, and his mail is open. It's like a birthday card that's open. He's super duper paranoid. He's like, because he's surveilling all the time, and he's this master, the surveillance master, it's like he's paranoid that he's being surveilled as well.
He hides his phone in a drawer in his desk, you know?
Yeah, he even denies having a home phone. He makes his calls from payphones and stuff like that. Sorry, go ahead.
Yeah, and I heard that it was actually kind of a hard character for Hackman to get into, because he's kind of a gregarious, friendly guy.
Mm-hmm.
And I guess to be this character that is just, it's not that he's uptight, but yeah, uptight, paranoid, closed off, like putting up walls
extremely
just to kind of protect himself.
Mm-hmm.
And, like, they talk about how, or they don't talk about it, they show that he's a Catholic. You know, he goes to confession, he's got, like, you know, the Virgin Mary statue and stuff like that. And so there's some major guilt stuff going on
for
here.
For sure.
Where it just seems like he's very consciously trying to be like, I don't want to know, I don't want to think about it, you know, but you can tell it actually does kind of eat at him.
Right,
you know?
Yeah, because what we learned is that some of his work does have consequences for the people involved, and in some cases it's resulted in murders.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, so he's riddled with this Catholic guilt, and the best way to fend it off is just to not engage with it and never try to interpret what's being said or whatever. So he's never confronted with the fact that what he's doing is actually could potentially be putting people in danger. That is until he goes to deliver this recording of the conversation to his client. And when he's in the building, he sees the subjects of the surveillance of the surveillance tape, this guy and this girl, like, just kind of walking out in the wild. And I think it was at that moment where he sees them in the wild, and he to take the subjects out of, like, this work context to place them in a public setting makes it seem to him probably seem more real, and like, okay, these are actually people that are walking around, and there's some kind of connection between, you know, this couple and this company and this director. Like, why is the director interested in these seemingly random employees? And like, you could tell by his face at that moment when he first sees the guy and then he sees the girl in the hallway that the theme of surveillance and privacy, I feel like, this is such a pure movie, because that theme is so present in everything. And as soon as the subjects of his surveillance are kind of invading his real life. He becomes shocked and he's confronted with that and he's uncomfortable. And, you know, and when I say that the theme, it's affects every part of the movie. I mean, like, even the way it's shot sometimes, it's almost shot like it's a surveillance movie. It's surveillance footage, like that opening shot where it zooms in slowly. It's from such an eagle-eyed distance that it's like, it feels so impersonal. You know what I mean? But anyway, that just speaks to Coppola's just devotion to detail. It's just absolutely incredible.
Yeah, it is interesting because, like, you know, we don't really see him before he was this master of surveillance before. So we don't know if he was kind of always like that or just through the nature of mm-hmm. his job of having to get into people's private lives that he kind of shut himself off from the world. And we see him with Terry Garr, who, like, we don't know if she's like a girlfriend or what the relationship is necessarily, or prostitute. Like, it's very unclear. I don't think it's prostitute because, like, she's trying to, like, get to know him and be friendly with him and, like, on a, like, a personal level.
Mm-hmm.
And he just kind of shows up and they kind of kiss and stuff and then he leaves, you know, and, like, he just doesn't want to get close to her.
Yeah.
You know?
I mean, it's consistent with everything else about him. Like, he wouldn't want to develop any deep relationships because he wants to be as fluid and movable as possible. Like, he doesn't want anyone invading his privacy. And I guess in his mind, having a significant other, a girlfriend who would know a lot about him would be definitely overstepping.
Yeah. And he's just so confident and capable whenever he's like, you know, later on we get to this surveillance convention and, you know, he's just like, he's the dude and he's mm-hmm. knows he's fucking good at what he does. But then you remove him from that specific professional capacity and his personal life, they don't make it sappy or a big thing. Like, it's just, like, very easily implied, you know?
Yeah. I mean, he doesn't really have a personal life. Like, his only hobby is just playing the saxophone. And when you think about how sound audio is such a huge part of what he does, the fact that his hobby is playing the sax, which is, again, a sound, and specifically jazz saxophone, which is pretty much just controlled chaos. It just shows how it's just like he is just trying to do anything he can to just not at all engage with emotions, engage with anything that would make him, you know, have to deal with the guilt. It's like he has these levees up, and then as soon as they break, he just be overcome with Catholic guilt.
Yeah, and you allude to, like, you know, when he saw them when he goes into the building, mm-hmm. that is the moment where that kind of breaks for him, because he sees them, and you said you can see his face, and he's kind of putting it together, like, oh, wait, what is this? It kind of, like, personalizes it for him in a way.
Yeah.
And so he goes up, and it's Harrison Ford up there that is the guy that is, like, basically hired him to get the tapes.
Another recurring face in Coppola movies.
Yeah, I wrote this down. You know, we in just the Coppola movies we've watched in the last month or so, Brando, Frederick Forrest, Robert Duvall, Harrison Ford, like, really reuses a good, like, I mean, mm-hmm. great choices. Awesome cast. But Ford is really good here in a role that I'm so not used to seeing him in. Mm-hmm. Like, Ford, to me, and to most moviegoers, I'd say, is kind of like the, hey, just kind of, you know, cool, confident, wisecracking, you know, bounty hunter, you know, Han Solo or treasure hunter or something like that. Like, he's the leading man, you know.
Yeah.
Here, he's this kind of, like, sniveling, kind of ominous corporate, not stooge, but just, like, kind of a, not mastermind, but kind of like the guy, a fixer.
Right.
You know?
Yeah. He's, I feel like he usually plays more, like, devil may care kind of attitudes and stuff like that. Like,
yeah, or anti-heroes. And...
Yeah. And in this case, he's just, like you said, total, like, corporate guy.
And calculating.
Calculating. And actually, in some ways, just as capable in invading people's privacy as Harry is.
Yeah, yeah.
Which was surprising because it catches Harry off guard quite a few times.
Yeah, but there's the part where he's going to give him the tapes, basically, that were commissioned. And then he just can't get himself to give it to him. Because, like, normally he would have just been like, all right, here's the deal, here's the transaction, but he just won't give it to him.
Well, that's because part of the arrangement was that he would be delivering the tapes to the director.
Right.
Harrison Ford is the director's assistant.
That's right.
And the director wasn't in, supposedly, so Harrison Ford wanted to collect it. I think Stett, what was that character's name?
Harrison Ford's I wrote it character. Down. Martin Stett, yeah. And it seems like Harry Call is the type that, like, hey, everything needs to be exactly. Like, you know, this is what we agreed on. It needs to be this way. And he does not feel comfortable about outside of that.
Right. And Martin's, like, really insistent on it. He follows Harry out of the building and Harry just doesn't give it up. But then, so later they have that big, like, surveillance convention mm-hmm. where obviously Martin can probably deduce, because Harry's such a titan in the surveillance industry, that he would be present there. So he ends up there as well. But why he's there isn't abundantly clear until, like, a little bit later in the movie, because he doesn't really have any direct interaction with Harry. But Harry does meet this, like... love interest, I guess. I forget exactly what the connection with her is. If she's
it just seems like a bunch of people, like, at a convention where it's like, I've seen this from going to, like, you know, E3s and PAXs and stuff. A lot of times it's just like a lot of people from the same industry are all together, and it's like, hey, after the show tonight, let's go to a bar where, hey, we're getting people together for karaoke after the show or whatever. So it seems like one of those things where, like, a bunch of people with the same industry all kind of meet up to get drinks and stuff.
Yeah, and because Harry is such a huge deal, like, as he's walking around the convention floor, everyone wants him to test out their latest inventions and stuff like that. Mm-hmm. One of these guys is kind of his primary competitor. This kind of sleazy guy. I forget the name of the character, but he has this invention where you call someone, they pick up, or you call someone before you press the last number. You press, like, a certain...
It's like a harmonica thing.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And then you press the final number, and then it turns their phone into, like, a recording device.
Yeah, so, like, when they pick it up, they don't hear anything, and then they hang up, mm-hmm. but then it, like, starts just recording ambient or whatever conversation's happening.
Exactly.
Which, if that's a real thing, or if that was back in the days of those type of phones, that's crazy.
That is wild, yeah. But, so Harry so kind of has so much hubris that he doesn't really entertain it as a useful thing. But yeah, so that's kind of important for later. Oh yeah, another thing is, like, this competitor puts a little pen in Harry's pocket and ends up being, like, a microphone.
And he does that as a, like, hey, look how good I am. Mm-hmm. Like, and I think he kind of wants to get into business with him and stuff like that. And I think that was almost like a little, like, hey, here's an example of why you should work with me.
Yeah, yeah. And Harry seems pretty skeptical about any up-and-comers and whatnot. But yeah, he ends up kind of humiliating Harry when they're back at his place for that party. Which, by the way, his office is... just like, it seems like this abandoned building, this yeah. totally empty floor, except for this one caged in area, which is like 1/20th of the floor. Everything else is completely empty.
Yeah, they're like riding mopeds around in this party.
Seems kind of cool, actually.
I thought it was pretty awesome, yeah.
But
little shop.
Yeah, so they have this get together, and his competitor's there, and he's kind of talking to Harry, like, kind of talking up Harry to everyone else. And then he mentions how, like, or he starts, like, speculating on how Harry pulled off this one job, and he mentions, like, that, you know, this one particular job resulted in the death of these people. And it was such a cool thing. Like, there was this kind of jazz music playing in the background because it was a chill party scene. And as soon as this guy mentions the dead people, like, the music cuts off immediately. And yeah. it's like, you as a viewer feel that shock as well, because it's so like disarming when that happened. And then you realize, like, oh, fuck, Harry went from, like, not listening or caring about what this guy's saying because he hears it all the time to, like, suddenly, like, having to kind of defend yeah. himself. And it's shortly after that he asks everyone to leave. But he stays with that woman that he ends up hooking up with, who ends up stealing the recordings for Martin.
Yeah, and real quick, you mentioned the music, mm-hmm. and there is a piano theme that recurs
so
throughout this that is... it is one of the best, like, just setting of tone mm-hmm. Themes I've heard in a very long time. It's just seems like just a piano. Just this weird, lonely, like, piano. It's kind of... I don't know, noir. I haven't seen enough noir.
It is very, very noir vibes, for
sure. Okay,
yeah.
But it just really just set the mood of this mm-hmm. movie. Every time it came on, I was like, oh my God, this is so good.
Yeah, yeah.
Very, very effective.
Perfectly fitting. All the music in this movie, all of the audio. It's one of those movies that you really, if you have a good sound system, it's worth watching it with, because it's it does some awesome stuff with audio, as you could probably imagine.
It is, you know, these movies we've been watching, the couple of movies from the last month, when you hear about, like, visionary directors and stuff like that, and especially after watching that Hearts of Darkness documentary, it's like, oh, you know, I've always heard that. And I know, you know, there are tons of, you know, great, great directors in the Spielbergs and Tarantinos and Scorsese's of the world. Mm-hmm. But, like, I feel like I'm seeing that more with Coppola mm-hmm. than anyone, because it just feels like there are so many just decisions that had to be made, that none of this happened by accident. Like, he just seems like he... was excruciatingly going over every single scene and sound and everything. And, like, mm-hmm. just seeing him on the set and how just commanding he was with just, like, every element of the production.
Yeah.
It's like, I have so much respect for him now. Like, he went from someone that is like, oh yeah, I think I saw Patton in high school and Dracula was cool, but I don't really remember much, to, like, now that we've watched a bunch more of his stuff, it's like, oh, he might be like my favorite director.
Yeah, he cares so much about the mood that whatever scene is going for, rather than bombarding us with a ton of sound and things going on screen, unless it's like warranted, like in one of the scenes in Apocalypse Now. Like he plays it so subtly, but it's so effective, the choices that he makes.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Hey, it's Kaylee Cuoco for Priceline. Ready to go to your happy place for a happy price? Well, why didn't you say so? Just download the Priceline app right now and save up to 60% on hotels. So whether it's Cousin Kevin's Kazoo Concert in Kansas City, go Kevin! Or Becky's Bachelorette Bash in Bermuda, you never have to miss a trip ever again. So download the Priceline app today. Your savings are waiting.
Go to your happy place for a happy price. Go to your happy price, Priceline.
Yeah.
But I think I missed one like pretty significant detail, that the more time that Harry's spent with these recordings of this surveillance recording of the couple talking, the more he was able to kind of align the frequencies and work out the kinks and reveal reveal more of what they're saying. And this part, like this movie thematically, is very similar to Blowout with John Travolta, mm-hmm. which we covered last year for the podcast.
We're both inspired by Blow Up, the 60s movie.
Right. Yeah. So a similar thematically, and some of these scenes too, like the way they treat like analog audio recording with such reverence, like showing every step of it.
Yeah,
you know what I mean?
I liked that.
Yeah,
you know?
It's kind of relaxing and really interesting to see, because you know, I'm sure there are still practitioners of analog audio that don't do like digital stuff, but by and large, it's going to be all digital mm-hmm. nowadays.
And so it doesn't look as cool as like the big reels,
totally.
And the big chunky buttons that hit. And
yeah,
stuff.
And it makes what he's doing so much more impressive as well. But yeah, so he's working out the kinks and revealing more and more of what they're saying. And as he does that, he starts to realize like, oh, okay, these people are actually in trouble, which makes them like that much more reluctant to give up the recording to the company that commissioned him.
Yeah. And they eventually find out the line that there's the one part of the audio he just couldn't figure out for the longest time, and finally figures out that Stan, the guy in the tape, says...
Oh, Stan is Fredo. Isn't Stan Fredo?
I'm sorry. Yes. Whoever Frederick Forrest is.
Yeah, I forget
the guy
his name as well,
in the conversation.
Yeah.
He says he'd kill us if he had the chance.
Right.
That's the thing he hears. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And so I think at that point, is it implied that like, well, okay, that is just him confirming his suspicions, right? It's like, oh, okay, yeah, this guy is going to kill them.
Yeah, the conversation between the couple, they reveal a specific day and a specific hotel room. Mm-hmm. And in Harry's mind, like, and keep in mind, like, Harry's always had this barrier between him and what he does, and he's never wanted to engage or participate in what's been going on or, like, kind of do anything to stop it. And now that he actually is, he's kind of letting his emotions and judgment kind of dictate what he's doing. And it's one of those things, like his emotions and his concerns and fears and guilt is kind of affecting his perception of the situation. But yeah, he wakes up, finds the recordings are gone. At that point, I think he goes back to the director, right? And he meets the director and Harrison.
He goes up to, yeah, he just kind of like walks in to the office there and finally meets him.
Oh, that was one of my favorite parts too, because he walks in and the director has these big Doberman pinchers, mm-hmm. these vicious looking guard dogs. And Harry walks in and the dogs are just totally cool with him, because he's obviously like a master sneaking guy. His like sneak seal is like at 100.
Yeah, and he's just like confident, like, you know, he's not going to like freak out and cause the dog to freak out, you know.
Well, yeah, I mean, I wouldn't call him competent. I just think he knows what he's doing, probably has learned how to deal with dogs, because then Robert Duvall, who plays the director, gives the one dog a look like what the fuck at one point, which I thought was cute.
I loved when it was clear that we were going to meet the director, and I like it whenever there's this unknown figure in a movie that's referred to for most of the movie, mm-hmm. but you don't see him, and then it's always fun for me when it's like, oh, at the end it's this well-known guy, like who was it at the end of Snowpiercer? There's somebody at the end of Snowpiercer, like the guy at the front of the train or whatever. Spoilers incoming for Snowpiercer once we can figure out who.
It's Ed Harris.
That's right. Mm-hmm. And yeah, exactly that type of thing where it's like, oh, man, Ed Harris at the very end, you know, like a fun surprise. And this was totally that. And Duvall It's been really fun because you weren't really super familiar with Duvall at all before we started this Coppola stuff. And so I've always just thought he was really cool. And to see him pop up, I was like, ah, that's the best case scenario for the Coppola stuff we're watching.
Totally.
And he doesn't even have that much to do here, but I just think he was a good pick for just like this kind of like older corporate exec who had this like younger wife. And like, it really just, it fits with the story.
Absolutely.
Completely.
Yeah. So yeah, this is where we learn that the woman on the tape is actually his wife. The guy is one of his employees, I guess. And it seems like, Harry doesn't want him to hear the tape because he thinks that it's going to reveal that they think that he's going to kill him, and it's just going to make him that much more likely to get killed or something. I don't know. But...
with the implication being that, like, oh, well, obviously this old guy is having his wife killed because she's having an affair.
Yes.
Like, that's the way this is all, you know, the viewer thinks that, Harry thinks that, just everyone that's in the know here seems to think that.
Exactly, yeah. So Harry decides to kind of take things into his own hands and go to the hotel where he knows the couple will be staying on Sunday. Mm-hmm. He gets like an adjoining room,
which is weird because, like, I don't know, if I worked at a hotel and somebody was like, I want this specific room, I would just instantly be thinking like, well, why? Like, can you do that? Can you request? I know you can request like, oh, can I be on this side and face the river or something? Or can I have a high up floor facing east or something? But like a specific room, I don't know. I think I would just be like curious. Why?
Well, I mean, what if like your family members were staying in that room?
That's a good point. That's a good point. Yeah. And so he says like adjoining room because he wants to be right next to the room.
Yeah. And he kind of starts to rig the room to so he can hear it, what's going on better.
Flushing the toilet while he's like drilling into the wall. Yeah.
Uh-huh. And it seems like there's a confrontation going on in that room. And when Harry steps onto the balcony to hear it better, he sees like a bloody scuffle and like a body pressed up against a window, like a window panel. And...
like a bloody handprint.
Exactly.
It's done so well because it's like, to the viewer, I didn't question it for a second that like you heard Robert Duvall yelling at her in the adjoining room. And even though you don't see it, it's pretty clear, oh, Duvall's angry. They're having this confrontation. You hear the woman scream. You see the blood. And it's like, yeah, I don't know how he killed her or whatever. But like, obviously, yeah, I mean, Robert Duvall killed her. Like the way it's shot, it's from Hackman's perspective pretty much. And it just 100% seems like it's, well, clear. It's clear what happened there.
Yeah, you know? And Hackman, like, as soon as he sees that bloody handprint, it's kind of like the levee broke and suddenly it's like, oh, shit, this person's getting murdered because of what I did.
Yeah.
So you immediately see him retreat back into his room, turn the TV up really loudly to try to, like, drown out not only the sound of what's going on in the other room, but, like, to kind of drown out his thoughts. Like,
He just can't escape. I mean, it's not a thing. He's not in danger, but, like, inside his own head and his own guilt and everything, like, how do you escape that? And he's just kind of, like, curled up on the bed, just, like, completely in a state of shock, you know?
Yeah, because, in his mind, his recording is what's responsible for that. And, later on, as things die down, he sneaks into that room using his level 100 lockpicking skill. And the room is just in immaculate condition. Obviously, the work of Martin Stett, who seems, like I said, super skilled in this type of stuff. Nothing looks disturbed at all. Like, the, little ribbon is on the toilet.
Yeah, the seal, Yeah.
And he flushes the toilet, and it's like in Breaking Bad when they would use acid to melt the bodies. It must have been something like that.
Well, that confused me so much as to why it looked normal, and then, like, if he flushed, was it clogged up because they had, like, dissolved his body? Well, you know, the body in the thing?
Yeah, I assume. Like, part of me wondered if it, like, was probably, if it was maybe just, like, a hallucination, but the movie hadn't done anything like that.
Well, except for the dream sequence. There's the dream sequence.
Well, that was a dream.
Yeah,
you know what I mean? That wasn't, that couldn't be confused with what was actually happening.
Sure, but that's the only time it's, like, stepped into something kind of surreal or just outside of just grounded reality, you know?
Yeah, but, I assume they melted the body down with acid and they tried to flush it down the toilet. It's not a good way to go. You're probably gone already at that point.
You would hope so, yeah.
Maybe it is a good way to go.
I don't know. I hope to never know.
Yeah, let's not be dissolved in acid.
Okay.
But yeah, so he's freaked out and he runs out and he sees this like limousine on the street, and as he's walking past it, he sees the girl from the video, and the girl that he thought he was sure was being murdered in the next room.
Yeah, we did too. I mean, you didn't suspect anything, did you?
No. And then suddenly it's just clear, like, oh, that was probably Robert Duvall that was gang murdered. And suddenly it's like everything kind of shatters, and everything we were led to believe, everything Harry was so convinced was true, was not true at all. And, you know, listening to the tape again, where the guy was like, he'd kill us if he had the chance. It's really like he'd kill us if he had the chance.
Yeah, it's the emphasis, because when you first hear it on the tape, the way Hackman hears it is kind of like, he'd kill us if he had the chance. Mm. But then the viewer gets shown like, oh, he'd kill us.
Mm-hmm. It's
like,
he'd kill us if he had the chance.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. It's, yeah, and like, you know, when he listened to the tape a bunch and like heard her kind of sounded like she was scared when she was like, oh my God, and like singing to try to distract herself, like in his mind it was like because she was scared, but the reality is she's probably just nervous, and you know, maybe these people aren't like, they don't seem to be like natural born killers.
No.
But it seems like in their mind it's kind of a greater good type of situation. And Martin Stett doesn't seem to disagree, because he is obviously fully capable of keeping the director from being murdered, but he seems complacent in it happening.
Oh, yeah. He seemed like he set it up, basically, with them. So, like, for this corporate takeover. So, like, the three of them, it's presumed, like, kind of took over the business after Duvall got killed.
Yeah. So, Harry, like, the ending is so fucking dark. Harry goes home. He's playing the sax. Gets a call. He picks it up. It's no one. He gets another call, and it's a recording of him playing the sax. And he's convinced that his apartment is bugged. And then he proceeds to just essentially destroy his entire apartment.
Tear up all the floorboards, the walls.
Everything. And I don't know if he was just in denial that the newfangled technology, which I mentioned earlier at the convention, that phone recording thing, but he was just too good to be outsmarted by it, or if he just didn't realize that that was an option and was just convinced that his house was bugged. And he just, so the last shot is just him in the wreckage of his house, just playing the saxophone. It's so fucking dark.
It's almost him just like, you know, turning up the TV, just kind of like, I just need to do something right now, otherwise I'm going to go insane.
Yeah. 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 It's an incredible movie. It's so good.
It's incredibly well done. Yeah. I love the framing. I like it in a movie. It's rare, I think, where at the very beginning, there's this thing that, like, without the context, you're seeing this conversation. It's the very first thing in the movie, and it means nothing to us. They're talking about, like, a homeless guy on the bench. They're talking about this and that and everything. And it goes on for a while. And I just remember thinking, like, okay, well, I don't know what any of this means. But then over the entire course of the movie, it is largely about unpacking what was said during that conversation and the ramifications. And, like, it all is in service of everything that happens in the
movie. Right. And how, you know, your perception can be so vastly different from the reality. I read that they actually did different takes of the, he'd kill us if he wanted to, like that, so that, you know, we could further kind of direct the viewer to what they wanted us to think.
Yeah.
But it was absolutely incredible. And to think of this, like, against the other movies, the other couple of movies that we recently watched, just his range of, like, the scale. Like, this was not an epic. This was a much more, like, singularly focused personal film.
Yeah, it's crazy because, like, look at the other two that, you know, the Godfather saga, this, like, thing. Even within a single movie, we're doing, like, a bunch of different decades and generations and covering the past. And it's crazy how wide the Godfather is in terms of scope. And then fucking Vietnam. I mean, Vietnam's a little more because it's not focused on the war in general, but
well,
it's
is an epic
boat.
Journey. I mean, exactly, maybe not time-wise, it's not an epic, but
that's
a
good point.
Even though I think it does take place over like quite a few months.
But yeah, it's like, you know, that is still set amidst this huge backdrop of the war and all this stuff, and then these big, you know, this rogue colonel. It's a much bigger story. And this is just like, and this is certainly something that would have made the news, like, oh, this corporate executive got killed or whatever, and like they show it hitting the news and stuff, but it's certainly not Vietnam or generations of the mafia levels of scale, you know?
Yeah. I think my ranking of the Cobble movies that we watched recently.
Fun. We didn't think about this. I didn't.
For me, Apocalypse Now is the number one.
Me too.
This is number two for me. I love the conversation. Yeah. Then I would say, obviously, Godfather and Godfather Part 2 are kind of even for me, but I would probably put Part 2 above 1, so yeah.
I would, and then, where's Dracula fit into that?
The last place,
Well, you know, it's saying something, because I think that won our best movie for the panties a couple years ago, didn't it?
I don't think so. I think,
Oldman won best actor.
Yeah, I think Cable Guy won that year.
That's right, Cable Guy did, but I think it was between that and Dracula. Mm-hmm. Let me think. Mine, Apocalypse Now is mm-hmm. number one. I would probably go Godfather 1, mm-hmm. then Godfather 2, and then between Conversation and Dracula are pretty close for me. I mean, but I love them all. Like, I love every single one of these
all
movies,
incredible.
You know? Yeah, and yeah, again, range. Like, Dracula is this other one. And, like, I know not everyone loves Dracula, and it's certainly not as tight as the 70s stuff, but it's a good one.
Yeah. Actually, Coppola said that of all the movies he's made, I think this was either one of, like, a few or, like, the only movie that he made that wasn't based upon, like, it was a fully original movie. It wasn't based upon an existing, like, book or what have you.
Yeah, yeah. It's incredibly good. Just
so good.
So well done.
So good. I loved it. And I absolutely loved it.
Happy to hear that that Hackman's alive, too. I hope Hackman doesn't die between today and this episode coming out, because we would look like damned fools and insensitive.
Well, I would be, yeah. If he died between now and then, I would be more sad about the fact that he died.
That would be the larger
like fools, Dan.
That's true. That would be burying the lead. The lead would be that Gene Hackman died. But hey, stay healthy, Gene Hackman. If you're listening, Mr. Hackman.
I know he's an avid listener. He's one of our dearest patrons.
Yeah, absolutely. Thanks so much. Your bonku's coming out. You're a little you're down the queue a little bit, Gene, but we'll get to you. But speaking of that, hey, the Patreon. If you go to patreon.com/paintingthestream, real simple. We got $5 a month tier. That's it. That's all you got to worry about.
What's
There's
that?
No multi-tiered business or
simple.
Anything like that. You get a few things. You get the ad-free episodes.
Wow.
You get the episodes a day early.
Wow.
You get access to the Discord.
Holy
over 500 people. Strong now. The Discord just keeps growing. It just keeps getting better and better. And also, you get written for you by Bonk. It is a personalized for you Bonk who? Bonk, do we have someone this week?
We sure do, Daniel.
Who do we got?
This week, we are honoring our friend Dane.
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 Hello.
Dane. Dane. Danish.
Dane Meister General.
Yeah. Divinely ordained Dane from
Great Dane.
From the Danish land of Great Danes.
Sure. This all works.
Anyway, Dane, this banku is for you.
Nope.
Dane pressed on the gas. His car peeled through the dirt road and over the cliff.
That's just a sweet one. Normally, they're like ominous or mysterious or something. This is just him hitting a fucking ramp. That's cool.
Yeah, I guess it could be a ramp, or he could have just driven off a cliff.
You had to take the dark turn. I thought he was just on a sweet San Francisco rush course or something. God damn it.
Listen, if I'm riding a banku for you, chances are you're going to be dead at the end of it.
Jesus Christ. That's a terrible...
Or you'll be possessed, or you're in court for some horrible crime. They runs the gamut, but none of them are particularly great. I think there's Yashir's Crack an Egg song was one
that
of
That was
the,
a good one.
Yeah.
Well, if you want to hear details on your grisly, mysterious death, join the Patreon at $5 a month and get your banku specifically for you. Before we go, I got a Hugh Game card in my hand.
Hugh Game.
We go. And it is, the question of this week is, what would you like to be able to experience for the first time again?
Ooh, for the first time.
Mm-hmm.
Well, not sex, because sex sucks for the first time.
Yeah.
As a girl, at least. Let's see. First time. Well, what about you, Dan? Have you given any thought? I will ponder while you answer.
You know, one of the first things that came to mind is playing Breath of the Wild again.
Ooh.
The Zelda game, because that is the, you know, people have asked me if I would go back to it or play it on stream or anything, and I've never had the desire, because it's like, that game for me was just about that discovery,
mm-hmm.
and like, I don't think I can rediscover or have that moment of the first time I saw that dragon,
sure.
or the first time X or X happened, the first time in the Lost Woods. It's like, it was all about discovery,
yeah.
you know, and
yeah.
I'm very excited for Breath of the Wild too. I hope it even gets a fraction of that feeling, because like, it is the most striking feeling a video game has ever given me since I was a small child.
Mm-hmm.
So I would love to have my memory, you know, Men in Black memory erased and then just play Breath of the Wild again.
Yeah, I mean, you know, it's like some of my fondest memories are from like games that I played back in the day, which I feel like if I were to play them for the first time today, I probably wouldn't have as great an appreciation for them. But if we're just being silly, I would say I would want to watch Face Off for the first time again. Because, Dan, I don't know if you remember, but when you showed me that movie, which was inexcusably long into our relationship before you showed me that movie.
Yeah, it was. I made a mistake.
I remember, like, I took an edible and it, like, wasn't kicking in. So I was just, like, highly skeptical of this whole movie. I was like, what the fuck is this shit? And then finally it hit me, and I was like, oh, yeah, this is the greatest movie I've ever seen.
I do remember you just being like, what is happening here?
Oh my
this
God,
is amazing.
Just, my mind was totally blown. And I've since seen it, I don't know, that has to be the movie I've seen the most in my entire life.
I'd say it's up there for me, but I know MacGruber and Commando and T2 are all higher.
Well, all you have to do is whisper the word MacGruber and you'll watch the movie.
I literally almost watched it last night. I'm not kidding. I was very close to watching it last night.
Yeah, I was listening to that, yeah.
Let's do a little miniature. Give me a minute or less rundown of, speaking of Nicolas Cage and Face Off. You saw parts of the very end of Vampire's Kiss on Pluto TV the other night. You were like, you were drawing or playing something or doing something, and I just I was going through Pluto TV, which is incredible. Mm-hmm. And I just put on the end of Vampire's Kiss. Yeah. And what were your thoughts on what you saw?
Okay, it seemed like there was a vampire lady. Okay, this is I don't know what happens in this movie. This is purely based on what I've seen. Okay, there's a vampire lady who is like a young, really pretty young woman who's like very together and everything. Then there's a vampire man, Nick Cage, who's not really a vampire. He just thinks he's a vampire, and he knows that this lady's a vampire, and he's trying to convince everyone else that she's a vampire, but she's so, like, calm and cool that she's, like, whatever. And he's, like, running through the streets all bloody and, like, screaming about being a vampire, and then he just ends up being, like, a hobo vampire.
But isn't he at full-blown Nick Cage back, like, in that?
This is, like, full-blown Nick Cage with, like, the 20-year-old Nick Cage energy.
Well, that's what's crazy is because, like, nowadays, I do love Nick Cage's current thing of just, like, I will take every fucking weird role you will throw at me. And he kind of leans into the wacky Nick Cage thing. But then you see this, and this is from the 80s. This is before he was even super famous. Mm-hmm. And he's being maybe even weirder back then. So it's like, oh, wait, maybe he's not leaning into this stuff nowadays. Mm-hmm. Maybe this has just always been him.
Yeah.
Actually, speaking of Coppola, it's actually kind of a direct tie there. He's a Coppola.
Oh, yeah, yeah. But there was that recent picture that was going around of him, like, walking down the street with his young son. And
oh,
he was just
my
like
God.
I don't remember exactly. It was, like, a top hat situation.
Weird Batman villain situation going on.
So I think that guy is very unique, for sure.
And just a joyous way. Like, I just love every Nicolas Cage story I hear. Just what a fucking fascinating weirdo.
That eternal question of, like, who you would want to have dinner with if you could have, like, a table full of people and you could just choose anyone. He would definitely be there for
me.
Well,
Tim Curry, your friend of mine, tried to, was in conversations with Nick Cage's people trying to have Nick Cage join us on the bachelor party night in Vegas, going around, like, shooting guns and jumping out the stratosphere with Nick Cage, which... conversations were had. I will always thank Tim for trying that, because that is what an amazing idea.
Yeah.
All right. Well, that is going to be it for this week. That's the end of it. We didn't have a specified month of Coppola like we've done, like Swayze and horror movies and stuff in the past. We just wanted to kind of watch a bunch of Coppola movies.
Yeah.
Was the plan.
Yeah.
So, yeah, that's going to be it for Coppapapapalooza.
Coppapapapapapapapapapapapapapapapapapapapapapapapapapapapapapapapapapapapapapapapapapapapapapapapapapapapapapapapapapapapapapapapapapapapapapapapapapapapapapapapapapapapapapapapapapapapapapapapapapapapapapapapapapapapapapapapapapapapapapapapapapapapapapapapapapapapapapapapapapapapapapapapapapapapapapapapapapapapapapapapapapapapapapapapapapapapapapapapapapapapapapapapapapapapapapapapapapapapapapapapapapapapapapapapapapapapapapapapapapapapapapapapapapapapapapapapapapapapapapapapapapapapapapapapapapapapapapapapapapapapapapapapapapapapapapapapapapapapapapapapapapapapapapapapapapapapapapapapapapapapapapapapapapapapapapapapapapapapapapapapapapapapapapapapapapapapapapapapapapapapapapapapapapapapapapapapapapapapapapapapapapapapapapapapapapapapapapapapap
But that's it for now. And it turns out, here's my takeaway. As a film, not major.
School
as a
graduate.
Film school graduate. As a guy with a film degree, I will tell you now on this podcast, Francis Ford Coppola is good at directing movies, or at least was very good at directing movies in the 1970s.
We'll just leave it at that. End of podcast.
There we go.
Thank you, Tom Monda.
Tom Monda, thanks for the theme song. Do all the podcast, 5 stars, all that stuff. Thanks, everyone. Bonk, bonk, bonk. I'll see you soon. I've been around you for an entire pandemic. Yeah. Like, we see each other all the time. I don't have to say see you soon to you.
You're only not seeing me when your eyes are closed.
That's true. And even then, I'm, like, directly next to you. So, like,
and
we
even
are...
then, you're dreaming of me.
Absolutely. Yes. All right. I will, we'll see you all next week.
Bye.
Bye.